Judges 15. And our theme this morning is Samson's Woman Problem, Part 2. Chapter 15 is an excellent example of how God uses simple, everyday events in order to fulfill His will and purpose. We will also see the many difficulties Samson has to face in delivering Israel. You see, salvation is a difficult work. But notice first of all, verses 1 through to verse 8. Thwarted in love. Thwarted in love. Here is a very touching scene. Samson's temper has cooled after his great disappointment that he experienced at his wedding. Things did not turn out as he planned, and he stormed off. Well, now he returns with love on his mind, and he brings her a gift. He's got a young goat under his arm, I suppose the equivalent of a bunch of flowers, and he's come, full of excitement. He knocks on the door, and he inquires, "Is the bedroom ready?" Richard Rogers, the Puritan, says, "Samson returns to her father's house to take and enjoy her, to do the duty of an husband to her." But an altercation occurs at the front door. First, he is informed her father has married her off to his friend. And then second, he suggests to him her younger sister. Well, Samson is evidently furious. He doesn't like any of these suggestions at all. And for such an act, it was but mockery by the Philistines of him and before the Philistines. And as a consequence, he destroys their goods. And then, of course, the Philistines retaliate, and they murder his wife and her father. And he slays them with a great slaughter. Here we see how a simple event, a marriage problem, becomes in the hand of God a significant event in providence. The Philistines are punished yet again. Because that, remember, is the whole thrust of God's work, to deliver Israel, to punish the Philistines, to ruin their lordship over the Philistines. And God, in His sovereign providence, He takes these ordinary events and He uses them as a mighty weapon to overthrow the Philistines. And then secondly, verses 9 to 17, betrayed by friends. Then the Philistines went up and pitched in Judah and spread themselves in Lehi. And the men of Judah said, "Why are ye come up against us?" And they answered, "To bind Samson are we come up, to do to him as he had done unto us." Then 3,000 men of Judah went to the top of the rock Etam and said to Samson, "Knowest thou not that the Philistines are rulers over us? What is this that thou hast done unto us?" And so on. Because of verse 8, the Philistines have had enough. Open warfare is now on the agenda. The Philistines have come to enforce their lordship over the Israelites. But it is at this point that things take an unexpected turn. An unexpected twist. Who would have thought that this would have happened? Verse 10 and 11. The Israelites turn against Samson. He who is their savior. He who sets out to do them good. To deliver them from the Philistines. Now, he who is their savior is opposed. And all that he is doing is for their good. But they cannot see it. You see, they had long ago settled into their bondage. They could not see anything different. They could no longer imagine freedom. No longer imagine being a unique and particular people under God before the world. No longer separated from the other cultures around them, separated unto God. No longer could they envisage an antithesis between them and the Philistines. They have become so accustomed to their slavery, they don't even have a relish for freedom. And pathetically, and it is pathetic, pathetically, they want to bind Samson in order to hand him over to the Philistines. It's astonishing, isn't it? He has come to deliver Israel. And they have said, we want to bind you. We want to stop you delivering Israel. We want to give you to the Philistines, that they may do to you as pleases them. Not only that, it gets worse. They regard the Philistines as friends and Samson as their enemy. What an unexpected turn. Who would have thought it? Well, thankfully, Samson doesn't agree with them. And though he lets them bind him, he has no intention of remaining bound. And he slays 1,000 war Philistines. This is what God called him to do. And the Spirit of God comes upon him and he breaks the cords and he slays 1,000 with a jawbone. And there we see the rightness of his actions, that the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. And then thirdly, sustained by God, verses 18, 19 and 20. Samson expends all his energy in delivering Israel. And he uses so much energy that he thirsts. He is weary. He cries unto God, shall I die of thirst? Shall it be that in the end I will fall into the hand of these uncircumcised Philistines? Great language from the lips of Samson. He understands the issues. He understands the importance of where a person is. Are they circumcised or uncircumcised? But to be an uncircumcised Philistine, the enemies of God, shall I fall into their hands? And Samson shows his dependence upon God. He called on the Lord. He called upon the covenant God. He who makes covenant, Jehovah. He called upon him. This God who is the God of his people. He has chosen a people for himself. Shall this God abandon him and leave him to perish amongst the uncircumcised Philistines? Well, God does not, because he is the covenant God. And God clave an hollow place that was in the jaw, and there came water thereout. God sustained him yet again. And he renames the place, Enhak Kore. We may call it Caller's Well, from Jawbone Hill, the Caller's Well. There you have a great summary of this battle. But let's come to the application of this. What lessons we may draw for our souls. We've looked at this chapter. We've got the main points of this chapter. Well, what now for us in light of this? First and foremost, all quarrels between husbands and wives should be speedily resolved. The Bible tells us that the only time there is to be a separation between a husband and his wife, according to 2 Corinthians 7, is for prayer and fasting, and then by mutual consent. Well, tragically, while Samson was away from his wife, it opened the door to great wickedness. Roger the Puritan says, Let every man avoid occasions of troubling himself in this way, as in others, by giving liberty to his corrupt affections. Samson, by going from his wife in a sullen and discontented manner, rather than wisely salving up her offense, now he has denied her when he would gladly have enjoyed her. Thus doth a man's sin crop off the blossom which should after in season yield fruit. Husbands and wives, don't be sullen with each other. When you fall out, be quick to make it up. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. You see, if you fall out, you go to bed and you sleep on it, it's harder the next morning to be friends and to make up. Speedily resolve your differences. Speedily resolve your differences. And look at this example we have before us. Samson waited far too long. Far, far too long. Yes, we know in the providence of God that God planned it all, but that's not the basis upon which we operate. We trust His providence, we trust His will, for we must follow His commands. We cannot peer into the providence or the decree of God. Samson ought to have speedily made things up. He ought speedily to have sorted out the issues and the problem. Learn from that example. Husbands and wives, don't fall out. But if you do, get it speedily resolved. And if you're not a husband yet, well, learn from this. And if you're not a wife yet, learn from this. Then secondly, betrayal doesn't in the end benefit. Betrayal doesn't in the end benefit. Chapter 14, verse 15. Came to pass on the seventh day that they said unto Samson's wife, entice thy husband. See the language. They want her to betray him, that he may declare unto us the riddle, lest we burn thee and thy father's house with fire. She betrays her husband. But did it benefit her in the end? It didn't. Because in chapter 15, verse 6, the Philistines burn her and her father with fire. Betrayal didn't profit. She tried by unlawful means to avoid this burning. It was by unlawful means that she ended up being burnt. That act of her father was unlawful, giving her away. She didn't anticipate perhaps that this would be the consequence, that Samson would go off in a rage, wouldn't be seen for dear knows how long. Her father gives her away to Samson's friend. Then Samson would come back. All this trouble would result, and ultimately the Philistines would burn him. She never anticipated this. How seldom do people learn? They think that by acting unlawfully, they can avoid trouble. They forget that other people act unlawfully too. And so the very thing they try to avoid may be the one thing that will come upon them with a vengeance. They think that if they act sinfully in one manner, they will avoid all kinds of troubles. But you know, God has a habit, shall we say, of paying back in the same coin. A habit of bringing to pass the very thing that people unlawfully try to avoid. What's the lesson? At all times, do what is right. No matter the consequences. It's very difficult. We don't pretend it's difficult, but at all times, do what is right. Because God is just, and God is holy, and God is righteous, and God is in charge. You see, by acting unlawfully, it's an atheistical mentality. Well, we will do this, and they will do that, and we will do the other. It's trying to work out the end result. Trying to anticipate all that's going to happen. We are not God. Nor does life operate on the basis of whim, fancy, luck, or chance. Our duty, do what is right. She should have done what is right. She should have trusted God. She should have trusted Samson's God. She should have said to him, look, you know, I'm not going to cry all day, every day. I'm not going to pester Samson. I'm not going to try and entice him. I'm not going to betray him, that he will tell me the secret and I will tell you, because you have threatened me. Why? Samson, he's a strong man. Look what he has done in the hand of God before. He can take on all of you. That's the way she should have thought. I will do what is right. I will trust. I will not be afraid. Isn't that what the psalmist says? Trust and be not afraid. That's what we should do. Just trust God. Don't be afraid. God is our refuge and our strength. The psalmist talks about all the turmoil that's all around. God is our refuge and our strength. And doing what is right, don't try to be like a god, to try and figure out every twist and turn that's going to take place. Do what is right. Leave the consequences with God. Trust God. Then thirdly, treading on the enemy. Verse 8, difficult to translate fully into English. He smote them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. The Hebrew has the idea of using the foot to smash the Philistines. And how appropriate is that whole idea that's there in the language? He smote them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. We might say in ordinary parlance, well, he put the boot into them. Well, the idea is he used his feet to trample on the Philistines. It's the ongoing fulfillment of Genesis chapter 3. And we've already seen it in Judges. Crushing the head of the serpent. Trampling the enemy under our feet. The promise in Genesis 3 of the complete overthrow of Satan, of the enemy. And as long as this age lasts, friends, there will never be peace for the people of God and for the church. There are always enemies against God's people and the church. There will always be a conflict between the church and the world. And if we turn back for a moment to Genesis 3, just to refresh your memory. And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Here we are told, in the first place, that the covenant is a word of judgment upon Satan. He shall be bruised. He shall be crushed. The head crushed. The head bruised. Secondly, the covenant is a revelation of two seeds. It's the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And thirdly, the covenant is a revelation of warfare. I will put enmity between thee and the woman. So here are these two seeds, and they're locked in perpetual conflict. The seed of the woman, however, is victorious. We see this in Judges. As I said, we've seen it time after time. This conflict between Israel and her enemies, between the seed of the woman, the seed of the serpent, the seed of the serpent trying to crush the seed of the woman, yet never succeeding. And so God raises up saviors for the seed of the woman, saviors of his people, to overthrow the enemy. Ultimately, we have the conflict at the cross. There is Satan using Judas to betray Christ in the belief that Christ will be finished. But Christ wasn't finished. He rose victorious, didn't he? And there Satan was overthrown. That conflict with Satan, however, still continues. And in due time, we shall see it completed. Because Paul talks in Romans 16:20 of that conflict being replicated in us. And he talks about trampling the enemy under the feet. Satan is already defeated. His kingdom has been overthrown. For Christ overthrew the kingdom. Christ bound the strong man. And what remains is, I suppose, we call a mopping up operation. Taking on all that is left of Satan's kingdom. Treading on the enemy. This is why the apostle says, resist the devil, he will flee. Because he's a defeated one. The book of Judges reminds us of this spirit of conflict and of this great warfare that God's people are engaged in. And we're not afraid of this conflict, but we must be wise in this conflict. The apostle speaks of knowing and understanding the wiles of Satan. That word wiles refers to the methods and strategies and tactics that Satan uses. We are to be wise to these methods, but not afraid of the enemy. Fourthly, be more in haste to render God his dues rather than Caesar. Be more in haste to render God his dues rather than Caesar. Verse 10, 11, and 12. Is it not astonishing how quickly some people are to express concerns about obeying Caesar when someone begins to stand up for Christ? Have you ever noticed that? Someone in the workplace, they take a stand as Christians. And suddenly they are surrounded with miserable Christians who say, oh, but what about obedience to Caesar? Suddenly they're all concerned about obedience to every other Tom, Dick and Harry on the planet. Yes, we all know we are to render unto Caesar. Everybody knows that. All Christians know that. But how many are concerned to render unto God his dues? And is it not the case that there are some busy rendering unto Caesar what actually belongs to God? Well, here is Samson. He's honoring God. He's standing up for God's people. He's seeking to liberate God's people. He wants to set them free. And yet those who would benefit are more concerned about obeying the Philistines than obeying God. This is incredible, isn't it? Suddenly, where were they when Samson was taking on the Philistines? They're busy at home, whinging. Then when Samson has slain a few of them, they come to Samson and say, oh, Samson, you mustn't upset these Philistines. They are our masters. We are to render obedience to Caesar. Samson says, well, what about rendering obedience to God? It seems to be okay to disobey God, but it seems dreadfully wrong to disobey the Philistines. They're not in the least bit concerned about disobedience to God. But they're awfully concerned and alarmed about being unfaithful to the Philistines. Oh, don't worry about being unfaithful to God, just so long as you're faithful to the Philistines. And what is more, as we have noted, what is even worse than this, or equally as bad as this, they're happy and willing to hand Samson over to the Philistines. They're quite happy to side with the Philistines against one of their own. Does this not gall us and upset us? When we see Christians taking a stand, all these others who are professing Christians are quite happy to betray them, to side against them, to side with the Philistines against God and God's people. It makes us cross and angry and upset, fills us with grief. They would rather have one of their own killed by Caesar, killed by the Philistines, than to stand up themselves against the Philistines. You know what we need today? What we need today is a holy jealousy for the honour of God. And we are glad when we see those who, rather than cave into the Philistines, will say, well, we will stand for God. Oh, it's not that they try to be awkward. It's not that they try to upset anybody. But they've grasped in black and white the issues. They say we must stand for God. Yes, it will embarrass compromising Christians. Because that's really the issue. It will embarrass them because they didn't take a stand. And they don't want anybody else to take a stand. They want everybody else to compromise like them. What we need are Christians up and down the whole country. In every aspect of life, in the home, in the neighborhood, throughout the whole country, saying we're going to take a stand for God. Even if it upsets professing Christians, we're going to take a clear, careful, diligent stand for God. Let the Philistines throw against us what they will. And we are thankful for these modern day martyrs, if we may call them. I mentioned earlier that couple who run a hotel. They lost their business. Clients simply cancelled bookings. All because a Muslim complains, oh, my religion has been offended. Well, this couple, they took a stand. And we rejoice at that. We think of many others in our age. Registrars and various councils have said, no, I cannot do this particular task you've assigned to me. Others say no and get away with it. But a Christian says no and suddenly it's the biggest crime on the planet. Well, we must stand beside them and say, yes, we will support them. Yes, we will pray for them. If we have an opportunity at some point to write to them or email them, whatever way we can contact them, we will show to them our support. And when we see one of God's people in the workplace suffering because they've taken a stand, let's stand beside them. And if they're not in the same business, well, let them know we support you. And if you end up in jail, we'll visit you all the time. And we'll look after your family if they've taken away your employment. But we will stand with you. That's what the Israelites should have done. They should have come to Samson and said, Samson, we are delighted. We are delighted at this conflict and we're going to stand with you. And there's 3,000 of us. It's not many. Against the horde of Philistines there in the valley before us. But we don't care. We're going to stand with you. It's the Lord's cause and the day of deliverance has come. And we are thankful that God has sent us someone who will lead us. He has taken a stand for us. And even though we may die in battle, well, we'll die in battle. But our God hasn't changed. That's how they should have thought. This God has never changed. And what a thrill to be in such an hour. Even though we may shed our blood. What does that matter? We're standing for God. That's how they should have thought. But they didn't. What a tragedy. They compromised. They had already given in. They had already surrendered to the Philistines. But thankfully, Samson wasn't perturbed by that. Yes, he said, look, do whatever you have to do, but don't kill me. Promise me that. But he still remained the same. He trusted God. And he still fought for Israel. Even though betrayed, he did not compromise. Fifthly, the joy of the wicked is always temporary. The joy of the wicked is always temporary. Verse 14, when he came unto Lehi, the Philistines shouted against him. The Philistines rejoiced, not for the first time. Not for the last time, But of course, the next time they rejoice, it's going to end in tragedy too. But here they are rejoicing. Oh, Samson is bound. Samson is our prisoner. Now we may do as we please. Of course, they perhaps are rejoicing too that the Israelites have handed him over, and they're laughing at the Israelites for being so cowardly and for caving in and for binding one of their own. They've got lots of reasons to rejoice. They see the Israelites divided amongst themselves, perhaps. Nonetheless, here is Samson, their prisoner. But you know, the wicked always forget something. The wicked always forget about God. Here they are rejoicing. But they're rejoicing too soon. There's an old proverb, he who laughs last, laughs longest. Well, these people are laughing too soon. They forget that God is in charge. That God has planned all that shall come to pass. He has planned it from eternity. His will shall be done. Remember Haman, he laughed too, didn't he? And he built gallows. But he laughed without God. One minute he's gloating, the next minute he's dead. We see it in Belshazzar. He's laughing too. Until the hand appears and writes upon the wall. He laughed too soon. God laughed at him. The Philistines are laughing. And then we read, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon Samson. The cords that were upon his arms became as flax that was burnt with fire, and his bands loose from off his hands. And he found a new jawbone of an ass and put forth his hand and took it and slew 1,000 men therewith. The tragedy of the unbeliever is that they think that when they are successful, they've done it all without God. God doesn't matter. Everything will be fine. The apostle says in 1 Thessalonians 5 verse 3, when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction cometh upon them, as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. You know how often Scripture uses that analogy? To constantly remind us, oh sinner, destruction always comes suddenly. When it's unexpected, it comes at the worst possible moment. At the moment when you think everything is well. Peace and safety. That's the folly of the wicked. They laugh without thinking about God. Sickly. Thinking like Samson in prayer. Thinking like Samson in prayer. Samson used two arguments in his prayer, as we have it recorded for us in verse 18 to 20. First, what God had done. And second, that God had used him in what he had done. So here are two arguments that Samson is using. What God had done and that God had used him. And from this, we can draw two lessons for ourselves. First of all, to remember all the precious or previous benefits God has given to us as an encouragement in prayer. So remember all the precious and previous benefits God has given. That's what Samson is doing. He said this is what God had done. This is what God has done. And he's using that as an argument with God in prayer. And that's what we must do in prayer. We remember his previous benefits. And second, that he served God for the good of God's people. Why did he exist? Samson is saying, oh God, you know the reason for my life, the very reason for my existence is to serve you, is to do good to God's people, is to overthrow God's enemies. And he uses that as an argument too. So he remembers previous benefits to encourage him in the present. And he also points out that he serves God for the good of God's people and the overthrow of God's enemies. These are two good arguments with God in prayer. Oh God, when I see all the benefits that you've given to me, why, you've saved my soul. Have you saved my soul that these other things have become irrelevant? You've done the greater, you can do the lesser. And you've kept me and preserved me and fed me. And you go over all the things that God has given to you. Then we come to a second argument. Oh God, thou knowest. Thou hast saved me to serve thee. I know I'm a failure. I know that I'm flawed. I know that sin ruins everything. But thou dost know that the great theme and thrust and purpose and aim of my life is to serve God and to do good to God's people and to overthrow the enemies of God's people. That's the reason for my existence. Now, O God, look upon me in the present. Here is Samson, and he's saying, Lord God, I am thirsty. I see the previous benefits. You know why I exist. Now you see my present danger, my present problem. Oh, God, hear me. And God heard him. Those two good arguments are arguments that we find constantly used by God's people when they're wrestling with God in prayer. There is a great study. The arguments of God's people in prayer. And you will find that these two arguments are constantly used. And then seventhly and finally, that troubles, they often come in groups. Troubles often come in groups. Look at poor Samson. And he's got a host of problems. First problem, his wife. Second problem, betrayed by friends. Third problem, he's hungry and thirsty. Isn't this what life is like? Troubles just don't come on their own. You know, if you just had one problem, that would be wonderful, wouldn't it? Just one problem. No other problems, just one. And that did you for a week or a month. And then you had your next problem a month later. The nights of life was like that, but it's not like that. It's just one problem after another and one difficulty after another. And sometimes there's two or three problems all come together. And you reach a point, you know, you've got your head above water. You're taking a deep breath. And a wave comes and, well, almost drowns you afresh. And you feel as if you're drowning. You're struggling underneath all these waves that are on top of you. That's what it's like. Well, here is Samson. And yet, through it all, God never changed. Look at the language of Samson. He called on the Lord, the sovereign God of all, the one who has made everything, and the one who governs everything, and the one who has planned all things, and the one who knows all things. This God. He could not trust himself. He could not depend upon his circumstances. But God had kept him. The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. God was with him through all these troubles. Samson judged Israel from 20 years. No doubt he often thought of that day he went down to see his wife. Love was in the air. It's harvest time. He went off to see his wife. And all the things that happened after. He could look back, could he not, and see the hand of God, even using his follies. Yet God triumphed. You know, when you and I look back over our short lives, can we not do something similar? We can see all our tragic faults and mistakes and follies, and yet we see the hand of God, how he makes everything just right. Always triumphing. God never changes. You change. You change constantly. You change your mind constantly. One minute you're for doing one thing, something happens, you change your mind. You'll do the opposite. Something else happens. You'll do a third thing, something else, a fourth thing. And on it goes. And then all these problems and troubles occur. We could be overwhelmed by it all. Unless we remember God. this God who saved us. He never changes. He neither slumbers nor sleeps. He always watches his people. Amen.